Hello everybody, I am going to record a lecture today on biology and race. You should already have the handout connected with the lecture, and I will be following the topical order that you see in the handout. Try to be point by point, but usually it will be clusters of one point after another. Now, the first thing about it is, why are we talking about race at all? There is no doubt that there has been racial progress in this country, especially during the last 20 years. In 2008, we did elect Barack Obama as president of the country, and he was elected with widespread support from voters of all racial backgrounds, and not only African Americans. And there was lots and lots of hope that he would usher in a post-racial society. Instead, we see almost exactly the opposite in two separate ways. One of them is we do not know the extent to which there has been police brutality and murder of African Americans in the past, because some of it clearly was covered up. But the Black Lives Matter has brought to the forefront how much of that continues even today. And the resistance to the Black Lives Matter movement also shows that there are underlying problems, racial problems in our society that we have not fully come to terms with, and it's not even clear that we are making that much progress with respect to it. The other part, of course, is that scientific racism has returned. Back in the late 1990s, it was plausible for Barkan to write a book called The End of the Retreat of Scientific Racism. Scientific racism is no longer under retreat. A few years ago, Nicholas Wade, a journalist for New York Times, wrote a book that was a defense of made the claim that allegedly modern science, modern biology, has brought race back into focus, and that not only can we have sharply designated, distinguished human races, that there are actual differences in performance with respect to different tasks in these races, usually as usual focusing mainly on IQ, and on this basis we as usual end up with the claim that somehow people of African origin, whether they live in the United States or elsewhere, are supposed to be not as good as people of other racial origins, and particularly people whose origin is in white Europe. This process also has been aided, strangely enough, by the fact that race is a category that is increasingly being used with and without very good justification in genomic medicine. The way that has come about is worth explaining in a few minutes. The promise of genomic medicine was that we would have a personalized medicine that takes into account individual differences between each of us. So somehow the idea was that our caregivers, our doctors, would look at our entire DNA sequences, and on the basis of what is unique to each of our sequences, devise therapies that are appropriate, clearly appropriate to us, appropriate for each of us with our particular genetic background. Now, clearly that has not happened. I bet no doctor has ever asked to see your DNA sequence, and no doctor within the next 10 years is likely to do so. So people have been there instead. Drug makers and others have begun to focus on groups of related individuals, and the favorite trope to use is that they're looking at groups of the same racial background, that there are actually races that we can talk about. And this is helped along by the fact that we do know that people of particular geographical and ethnic origins have different different frequencies of certain genes, and then those include disease genes. For example, if you are descended from, say, Africa, tropical Africa, South Asia, the Mediterranean region, you are more likely to carry the sickle cell allele than if you're descended from other groups. And in fact, there is a selectionist story to be told why you would do so. The presence of the allele in one copy, that is in a heterozygous state in you, would give you some protection against malaria. And we are talking about those areas of the world where historically malaria has been most prevalent. And so the slight advantage in the heterozygote to possessing one allele for sickle cell hemoglobin gives you an advantage over those who have only normal hemoglobin and not sickle cell hemoglobin. Similarly, there are there's Tay-Sachs disease, which is supposed to be associated with Ashkenazi Jews, and then people of that sort. Now, that's the kind of thinking that has led to some racial analysis in genomics, and we will have a lecture on that. But right at the beginning, note that there are problems here. When we lump together people from Africa, South Asia, and people from the Mediterranean, we are not talking about race in any conventional sense. Similarly, it is not intuitively obvious that we can in any sense talk about Ashkenazi Jews specifically as a race, rather than as Jews who have a particular genetic background, partly because a lot of their ancestors have lived in Europe for many, many generations. Of course, and whenever we talk about race, we are also talking about racism in some form or the other. And at the University of Texas, of course, we have very good reason to do so. Many of you will probably have had to have taken classes at RLM. That's the building that houses our very, very prominent mathematics and physics departments. It's named after Robert Lee Moore, who was a faculty member who refused to teach African Americans and, in fact, walked out of a lecture once after discovering that the speaker happened to be African American. The university administration has resisted changing the name of the building, and I myself refuse to enter it, go to the library in it, or teach in the building, and I wish others would do the same. It is something that needs to be changed. So what is our task then? Why are we talking about biology and race in a class on the philosophy of science, that's dealing with science and philosophy? I hope the answer to some extent is clear, that the use of race in genomics has made the issue of whether or not that is appropriate a topic that is extremely important to science today. That's why we are focusing on it. 15 years ago, I probably would not have focused on it because race would not have come to the forefront of genomic research at that point in the way that it has now. And what I propose to do over here is to try to paint the picture of what we mean by race and ask very, very critically the question whether or not races are real. Real in the sense that we will see this in some detail later, that we can define them precisely and use this definition to categorize people in a very useful and non-arbitrary way, that somehow or the other, science supports the idea that they're distinct human races to which people belong. Now, the first thing to remember, of course, is that when I say that there may not be distinct human races, I'm not making a claim that denies the existence of racism. As long as people believe that there are distinct races and different people belong to different races, and when they couple this with a value judgment about these different races, that generates a problem of racism, whether or not races exist, either in a cultural sense or in a biological sense. Now, what does it mean to say that something is real? We take this to be fairly obvious, and very often, for example, we'd come out and say that, well, unicorns are not real. Rhinoceroses are real, but not unicorns. Now, and it seems to be obvious that we know what we mean, but what does it mean to say unicorns are not real? My daughters, for example, believe that there are unicorns out there in some fantasy world that they also belong to. They know, the older daughter, who's 4 years old, know that this is a make-believe world and not the world around us. But in this make-believe world, the unicorns exist and they have causal powers. They do things to objects, they do things to other members of the world. And this make-believe world actually interacts with our world. When I take my daughter to a bookstore, she rushes off and wants to buy books with unicorns in them. Similarly, when she chooses what books I have to read to her, books with unicorns are among the favorites. The presence of the unicorns makes a difference to her. So in some sense or the other, I can come back and say that there is the unicorns are real in the same way electrons are real. I don't see electrons. I don't see unicorns. Unicorns affect my daughter's behavior. Electrons affect my daughter's behavior. They affect the behavior on the computer in which this lecture has been recorded. So we really need to be careful. In fact, what philosophers will point out is that the predicate is real by itself does not mean anything. It actually is supposed to be shorthand for what we actually mean by it. So when we say unicorns are not real, what we mean is that if we walk into a forest, where anywhere in the world, unlike the case of rhinoceros, we are not going to run into unicorns. In other words, the ways in which unicorns are real is very different from the ways in which rhinoceroses are real. Now, or say chimpanzees are real. And now if I go to chimpanzees, as we shall see later on in this lecture, I will be able to divide up the species into three very distinct groups, which I will call subspecies of that. And that's the sense in which chimpanzee subspecies, which are going to be equivalent to chimpanzee races, are real. And so when I ask whether or not biologically human races are real, what I'm asking is, can I take the human species and divide them into a certain set of certain groups to which people belong, and these groups are as distinct as the chimpanzee subspecies were, and each of these distinct groups corresponds to a race. Now, I am going a bit ahead now of the lecture. So far, I've been talking about points 3, 4, and 5. What does it mean to call races real? Let me focus now on point 6, which will look at this question in some greater detail, and we'll do so first independently of biology, and then we will come back to the biological basis for race, and that will be primarily when we get to points 13 and 14. So now I will be dealing with point 6 first, and then altogether points 7 through 12. The point 6 is asked, well, look, if we want to have a biological or any, sorry, scientific basis for race, whether or not we primarily use biology, what is it that our definition of race must accomplish? And philosophers approach this sort of a problem very often by laying out what they call adequacy conditions. That they say that the concept has to satisfy a certain set of conditions which are supposed to be so intuitively obvious that nobody really wants to deny them. They're part and parcel of our thinking on the subject. And then you can have multiple definitions that the concept can have, and require that each of these definitions, while they satisfy all these criteria, and while the definitions can differ from each other on matters of detail, they all have a certain commonality in the sense that these criteria are satisfied. And for the case of race in general, even independent of biology, we have 6 of these criteria. They're points A through F. Of 6. So 6A says, race must be defined in such a way that the entire human population can be subdivided into a finite set of more or less discrete races. I use the qualification more or less only because we know that they are mixed race people. So some people, the boundaries might be a bit blurry, but by and large, we can separate people out in such groups. And these groups must be such that every person must belong to a particular group. We don't have a proper racial classification of human beings if a large segment of human beings are completely left out. The funny example I use over and over again, at one time it was very common to divide up the entire human species into 3 races. And those 3 races were supposed to be the Caucasoids, right, referring of course to whites, the Negroids as they call them, referring of course to people of African origin, and the Mongoloids, which are people of East Asian origin. Seems very, very useful, but you've left out all of South Asia and 1.5 billion people. You have left out about a fifth of all humanity, and that's not exactly a good concept of race to have. Point C says that the differences between these races must be significant. If the differences are very minor, say, for example, the difference between an Indian and a Pakistani, that is not exactly a racial difference, that there is some meat to it, that it really matters which race that you actually belong to. And that within the groups, whatever differences they are, this is point D, those should be very, very small compared to the differences between the groups. That's crucial. So the racial group must be homogeneous within itself and different from other homogeneous groups that are the other races. Otherwise, it's not really a concept that does much for you. And then, by and large, we believe that these different groups must have their historical origin in different geographical areas. The folk conception of race generally assumes so. Whites are supposed to be of European descent. Blacks are supposed to be of African descent, though that's kind of a joke, given that everybody is of African descent, and on the one hand, and on the other, the the Melanesian blacks, the aboriginals of Australia and people like that are about genetically as separated from Africans as you can get, because they were descended among the earliest peoples who left Africa in the early stages of human evolution. And then the final part of it is that once we end up with a racial classification with the races properly defined, the categories we end up with as races are commonly what we think of as the races of humanity. That is, they correspond to what we would call the folk concept of race, how race is used. Now, here, of course, we immediately see that we are going to run into problems. The folk concept of race is particularly bizarre. Nowadays, if you look at the U.S. Census, and probably several of you have recently been filling out those census forms, this is the year where the census is taking place, they give you five racial groups: white American, black or African American, American Indians, and Alaska Natives, they're supposed to be the same race, Asian American, and Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islander. The census seems to have no idea how much diversity there is between Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islanders, which can correspond to people of very, very different physical characteristics. At one time, the Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islander and Asians were all lumped together as a single race. This was back in 1990, just 20 years ago. And if you go back to the 19th century, first you had just three races, black, white, and mulatto. And then you had at one point eight races, black, white, mulatto, American Indian, Chinese, Japanese, quadroon, and octoroon. I am going to leave it to you to figure out what quadroons and octoroons are and what exactly happened to them. These races of human beings seem to have just disappeared. Even in more recent history, if you go back to the 1920s, you find the different ethnic groups coming from different areas of Europe were all classified as different races. There was, as we shall see in the next lecture, a lot of racism back then, and this was directed using IQ at people of Southern and Eastern European origin who were supposed to be completely different races from the Nordics, who is what the racists wanted to put at the top of their hierarchy. So our folk concept of race has not exactly been stable. And it's probably only since World War II that there has been this exclusive fascination with skin pigmentation, as if that is all that matters when we try to understand human diversity. It is very, very odd. And we should not forget the strangeness of this enterprise. Now, the concept of race originated in the 18th century in Europe. And one of the things we need to remember, especially on a lecture on biology and race, that biology has been central to this concept right from the beginning. It emerged about the time when Linnaeus in Sweden was giving the modern classification of species, where species at the end of the day are identified by two terms. We are Homo sapiens, where Homo refers to the genus to which we belong, and sapiens is the species-specific name of modern humans. Early humans, for example, included Homo erectus. These are part of the genus Homo, but erectus indicates that it is a separate species from sapiens. Now, of course, since Linnaeus, this classification was developed a lot more, and we'll have a fair amount more to say about it later on when we get to the issue of whether races are subspecies or not. But then following Linnaeus, other figures who worked on this concept and developed it included Kant and Blumenbach. And the project right from the beginning was not only biological, it was always accompanied by a normative project. Values were associated with different racial groups, and no matter how the Europeans divided up the world into races, they always ended up making sure that the Europeans were on top and the others were below them. And of course, we all know that this assumption, the value assumption of the Europeans being better off racially than the others, was central to the colonialist and imperialist project, and each and every one of us have probably heard of what was done in the name of the project, from the treatment of Native Americans in North America to the complete genocide that was directed against the African population of Namibia by Germans who conquered the area towards the end of the 19th century, what white Australians did in hunting down native Tasmanians in Tasmania and so on. And of course, all this thinking ends up in the 1930s with the Holocaust in Germany. And that's the context in which the term racism was first invented to describe the ideology of the Nazis. So we have a very, very complicated and gruesome history. But before we begin to suddenly now decide that somehow Europeans are particularly special in terms of evil, we should remind ourselves that similar kinds of thinking, including the endorsement of slavery, existed all around the world. Aristotle tried to justify slavery just as much as Locke tried to justify slavery in the context of modern Europe. And also there have been other classifications of humans into different groups that have been as oppressive as racial classifications, in particular the caste system of the Hindus, which to this day continues to be certainly as oppressive as racial classifications anywhere. And in fact, the Hindu castes might correspond to biological races much, much better than European classifications of race ever did, because the Hindus did believe in endogamy, marriage within the group, restricting marriages to within the group, which has always been central to ideas of subspecies. All right. Having said that, it is clear that in some sense it's natural to look for something that is biological about race. So I am now moving on to points 11, 12, and then we will go on to 13 and 14, which are going to be absolutely critical. So besides the fact that the historical origin of the concept of race refers to biology, turning to biology in the case of race played another serious role that has been important in the use of the concept of race to promote racism. And that's the idea that if something is biological, it cannot be changed. The contrast here is with culture. So let's take an unproblematic example. The language I'm speaking to you now is English. And that is because of my cultural origins. I was taught this language early, as were most of you, and so we all do so. But there are other people in the world who were first, and some of us probably were first taught, including me, were first taught other languages than English. But some people might have only been taught some other language, say German or Hindi or Swahili or Mandarin Chinese or any of these other languages. So clearly this is a function of culture. We even know that for somebody really to become a native speaker of a particular language, he or she has to be introduced to the language very early, preferably by the time when they're around four or earlier, and that they continually speak it all the time until they are in their teens. And if so, they're native speakers in some sense, never lose their ability to speak that language. But on the other hand, there's also in humans something that is far more biological, which is basic syntactic ability, grammar. Children exhibit knowledge of grammar very, very early, even when they have been exposed to a very limited repertoire of the grammar of that language. They pick up grammar very, very easily, and by and large, we believe that to be biological or innate. This naturally leads to the idea that whereas we can teach different languages very, very easily, and that culture makes a difference, switching over to a different grammatical set, completely different grammatical rules at the very fundamental level is virtually impossible to accomplish. All right, I've started out with a particularly apposite, useful example, because the way in which that will play itself out in a racial context is that if you are something because of your race, that is something about you that cannot be changed, and that will be passed on to future generations from you, your progeny, and they will also be born with those characteristics that are their racial characteristics and cannot be changed. And now you see that we have a recipe for oppression and disaster. Add to this the assumption, which we will deal with in the next lecture, that intelligence is something that can actually be measured, that it is appropriately measured in IQ, that it gets inherited from generation to generation, and that there are different human races and they vary in intelligence, and some of these races have lower IQ than the others. Well, lo and behold, we conclude that if these particular races with low IQ are in a subordinate social position, that is something that cannot be changed by cultural intervention, for example, through better education, better nutrition, or any of that. And these races are just destined to be at the bottom of the social ladder endlessly. Biological determinism is therefore something that can be invoked, that can be used in the context of race to do really harmful things in its name. And biological determinism only became very prominent within biology and then within society, starting towards the end of the 19th century. Darwin's theory of evolution certainly played a role, as you see in social Darwinism, as developed in the United States. But the theory of evolution may not have been the most important thing that led to the emergence of biological determinism. In fact, what probably made the most significant role was the emergence of Mendelian genetics around 1900, accompanied by the idea that genes only change because of mutations, which happen because at random and not because of environmental factors. And in fact, any character that you acquire environmentally, for example, what language you speak, is not biologically inherited, is not inherited through the genes. And this hardened view of heredity, where there is no inheritance of environmentally acquired characters, only became the dominant ideology of biology in the 1920s. And that was the same period in which holistic thinking about group identity of humans became very, very prominent too. And I have, with partial irony, often suggested that a wonderful equation to describe the 1920s and the 1930s and the emergence of the Nazis is to write down Mendelism plus holism equals racism. So that's how all of this comes out. Now, let us turn to the question whether biology, we already earlier talked about adequacy conditions for the concept of race in general. Let us turn to the question as to whether biology in particular can give us a good concept of race. Now, part of the reason we have to do so is because it's going to be useful in the context of conservation. So look at you as a human being, okay? You belong to a species, we've already talked about that. You belong to a genus. You also belong to higher level groups. The next level after genus is family, the next prominent level, then there's order, then there's class, and there's phylum. The phylum that you belong to is Chordata. Underneath there are separate subphyla. The particular subphyla that you belong to is Vertebrata. There is another subphylum under Chordata, which are not vertebrates, chordates, but not vertebrates. These are the tunicates, which have spinal cords when they're in the larval stages, but not afterwards. So there's this complicated thing. Above phyla, you have kingdom and domain. One thing that biologists emphasize, that this classification, the separation of groups into these particular categories, is not entirely obvious. It's partly conventional, and that is indicated by saying that there can be lots and lots of disagreements as to how many genera, for example, there are within a family. But at the same time, biologists actually recognize that at least two of these levels are in some sense more real than others. We are back to the question of the reality of the race. Here, what we do have is good reason to believe in the reality of species and of phyla. In both, that these are levels of biological organization that are particularly well characterized in the sense that they're discrete entities in them, and it makes sense to talk of precise differences between two species that might be quite similar to each other in some ways. Similarly, at the level of phyla, it is fairly obvious that these different phyla are constructed according to different plans. These are the things that are called Bauplans, German for construction plans, which is often inaccurately translated as body plans, but over there. Now, that's all just biology in general. What about races? Now we are beginning to look within species. Are there specific levels within species that are as well defined as species themselves or phyla themselves, or are they as poorly defined as, say, order or something of that sort? Now, clearly, the differences that you see within species, any levels within it, are not of the same level as species. Nevertheless, there are some levels that are more important than others, and these are widely recognized in society. In the United States, for example, the Endangered Species Act of 1973, which is one of the strongest and most important environmental pieces of legislation the world has ever seen, wants to protect just not every species, but also every subspecies of a species. And the question then becomes as to whether or not these subspecies are real and how exactly would we, in a legal context, define them. This is where I must urge you to read Templeton's paper very, very seriously. What he notes is that there are two standard strategies that can be used to define subspecies. One of them is that they are geographically separated subsets of species that have sharp boundaries with other such subsets. And the other one is to say they're distinct evolutionary lineages. And nowadays, when we have lots and lots of genomic data, very, very precise and useful techniques have been developed to look at these, that are developed to identify subspecies in both of these ways. And subspecies are supposed to be what races are. In fact, subspecies and race were used pretty much synonymously in the 19th century, and then the concept of race virtually disappeared for non-human species in the 20th century. But if there is any biological concept of race to be defended at all, it has to be at the level of subspecies. Now, the technique for finding races as geographically separated things that is known to be very, very useful is called AMOVA, the analysis of molecular variation. And the details don't really matter to us. What happens is we use a statistical measure to look at how homogeneous the group is inside and how that homogeneous group differs with other homogeneous groups. And we compare the two and we come up with it. We then have to use an arbitrary threshold to say that if you cross this threshold, then you belong to distinct species. You have subspecies. If you do not cross this threshold, you do not belong to distinct subspecies. Of course, this is open to the objection. The threshold is arbitrary, but in the human case, it doesn't matter. The threshold can be varied a lot, and the results are going to be the same. The same is true of chimpanzees. In the case of evolutionary lineages, there has been a lot of biological work done on it, and we have come up with some very, very good methods to separate out groups into different lineages if they exist. And if they do, then the entire group that has been separated out looks like a tree in which each lineage consists of a branch of the tree. How good is all that? What happens when we apply to humans? Well, to see how well this is all that, let's start by applying, as Templeton does, these definitions to the case of chimpanzees. And I'm on point 17 now of the handout. Traditionally, chimpanzees were divided into five separate groups on morphological grounds. And the question then becomes is that are these groups now, using all these molecular techniques, the much more precise techniques that we have today, are these group distinct groups as we would hope? And it turns out they're not. What these techniques do, and both techniques give you exactly the same result, that instead of five subspecies, you end up with three chimpanzee subspecies. The fact that both techniques give you exactly the same result should both give you some confidence that we are identifying races accurately for chimpanzees, and also that we have hit upon the right set of techniques to use when we analyze all these molecular data. What happens when we come to humans? Both techniques just simply do not give us any subspecies or racial classification. If we look for distinct groups, we do not find them at the genetic level. Instead, we find lots and lots of genetic differences between humans, but the extent to which two different human groups differ genetically very much depends on the geographical separation of the groups. Geographical separation is geographical distance, taking into account things like the existence of barriers such as oceans, mountains, and deserts. Once we do that, we see continuous variation in frequency across the human groups, and we do not get distinct subsets that would be candidate species. When we begin to look at evolutionary lineages, we get the same result. Humans first left Africa some 1.9 million years ago, and we can't say very much of what happened immediately afterwards. We do not have genetic records of that period. But then another group, humans again left Africa 65,000 years ago, and there were two other major out of Africa leaving out of Africa events. And then we get into something that looks like a complete trellis structure, with gene flow outwards, gene flow inwards into Africa, and also as humans spread around the world, we get more and more expansion of humans into different areas. We get a very complex and fascinating picture of human history, but the resulting genetic structure of the human population does not in any way look like a tree. We do not get distinct evolutionary lineages. The obvious conclusion to draw from all of this is that there are no human races in the biological sense. The only notion of race that we have is a cultural notion. It's been very unstable, as we saw. Cultural classifications of race have been very, very different over the years. Biology does not give us race. That's the final message. This has been, for a recorded lecture, this has been longer than intended, but that is partly because I've been trying to distill into this lecture what, had class met, we would have had three different lectures about. All right. Thank you. Bye.